Rejoice, baseball fans. It is opening day. We're getting set for the season with the Washington Post Chelsea Janes. Plus, March Madness is breaking viewership records, and it's likely not done, especially if things break a certain way in the Sweet 16. And NCAA President Charlie Baker wants to ban prop bets on college athletes. It's Thursday, March 28th. I'm Owen Poindexter, and this is Front Office Sports Today. Business of the Madness is brought to you by Acura, which is now introducing the all-electric ZDX. Crafted using the same formula that brought them electrified supercars, the ZDX is Acura's most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy at Acura.com. Time now for our weekly look into the world of sports media with tuned-in columnist Mike McCarthy. Welcome, Mike.
Great to be here.
Great to have you on. So we're through the first two rounds of March Madness. What have the ratings looked like so far?
Record ratings, averaging over 9 million a game, despite all the caterwauling and the crazy drama over who got left off. The ratings are doing very, very well across four networks. So far, so good. You still got Duke in there. You still got UConn. So things are looking really good.
Yeah, I mean, so we do have some marquee teams. It actually has been a pretty chalk-heavy tournament so far. Is that what you would point to in terms of why we're seeing these record ratings?
I don't know if it's the teams so much as it's there's an intense interest right now about college basketball. And I don't think it's just the women's game, but I think the women's game is a big part of it. I think, you know, Caitlin Clark and the whole NCAA tournament has just been the buzz this spring in a way it hasn't been in before. I mean, when you saw Caitlin Clark the other night, you know, for an early round game getting, you know, 4 million viewers, it's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we spoke to a producer at ESPN on this show, and I said, you know, do you want the intense matchups where it's, you know, a 7 and an 8 seed or the big names? He's like, you know, the big names. You know, it's, you know, that's what drives the viewers more than anything. Speaking of Caitlin Clark, if Iowa and LSU each win their next games, we will have a rematch of last year's women's final in the Elite Eight. How would you think ESPN would feel about that?
Well, I think ESPN executives are praying to the sports ratings gods at this moment for that to happen. I mean, imagine the storylines in this. You know, LSU going for a second title, Caitlin Clark getting her revenge on Angel Reese. It would be phenomenal, Owen. I spoke to Doug Pucci. He's a ratings expert. He thinks that this game, even though it's Elite Eight, could come close to beating last year's title game. That's how much interest it would generate.
Yeah, absolutely. And then you've got one of those teams headed to the Final Four. And yeah, someone's going to be carrying that torch of like the team to watch. And then probably one of them is going to, you know, run into, you know, at least one of like Stanford, UConn. You know, it could be some good fireworks coming our way.
Definitely. Definitely. And one of the great things about this time of year, and Ian Eagle said it, is, you know, we find ourselves talking about somebody who nobody ever heard of a week ago. And right now, that's that Robbie Avila kid for Indiana State in the NIT. You know, he's got great nicknames, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Milk Chamberlain, Larry Nerd. You know, he's been one of the breakout stars of this whole March Madness, even though it's not actual part of March Madness.
Yeah, and it's nice to see something from the NIT getting some attention. That's kind of been the forgotten tournament here.
That's right. It is kind of a forgotten tournament. And that's the shame of college basketball, is that it always just comes down to March Madness. Everybody kind of forgets the regular season, forgets the other tournaments. But, you know, that's sports. Nobody remembers who the loser is in the Super Bowl. You only remember the winner.
Yeah, absolutely. Jumping back to LSU for a moment. Kim Mulkey, you know, has gone on offense against an article that hasn't even come out yet. We don't really even really know what it's going to say, from this Washington Post reporter, Kent Babb. You spoke to Kent. What kind of sense did you get from him?
Actually, Kent was surprised. I didn't speak to him. Our editor, Tim Marchman, was emailing with him. And he said that, you know, his story wasn't really about Brian Kelly. And it wasn't. Brian Kelly was tangential to the story. But there was one important thing, and they juxtaposed Brian Kelly's huge deal with the general poverty around Baton Rouge. And my history, Owen, whenever you start asking coaches about their multi-million dollar contracts and perks and being the highest paid state employee, they get very sensitive. So that could be what's driving this.
Right. So yeah, Mulkey's kind of reacting to this, you know, what she thinks is coming based on something, yeah, Bab wrote a little while ago.
Mulkey herself is the highest paid women's college basketball coach in the country. And, you know, and she shares the coaching fraternity with Brian Kelly at LSU. So she's very sensitive. As you said, she's gone on the offensive. She's threatened a lawsuit. She claims she's hired a defamation attorney. So we're all just waiting on pins and needles for this story to drop. We'll see what it says.
Yeah. And, you know, I may or may not have read that story before all this. Now I feel like I have to.
You know, you put your finger on it. You know, Shannon Sharp said it. 100 people have said it. You know, I wouldn't even have known this story existed in the midst of March Madness. But after that press conference, everybody's going to read it.
I get why coaches are sensitive about this, because they're university employees. And you look at, you know, they're making as much as like every professor combined, essentially, which is an uncomfortable place to be, because, you know, is the basketball coach really more important than, you know, the English professors?
Yeah. I mean, I remember Jim Calhoun, you know, just freaking when somebody asked about this a few years ago, and Dabo Sweeney went on a 5-minute rant when somebody mentioned his contract. You know, it's a trigger point for them. And I think part of it is, you know, maybe media training. Maybe they need some media training on how to handle these questions. Because if you make that kind of money, and if you're the highest paid state employee, you better expect to get those kinds of questions at some point. You know, the media is not going to be always compliant student journalists who are going to ask you what you want. Sooner or later, somebody's going to ask you a tough question, and you're going to have to know how to answer it.
Yeah, absolutely. Mike McCarthy, always a pleasure. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Speaking of March Madness, we are giving away a hat each day of the tournament to someone who reviews this podcast on Apple, screenshots the review, and sends it to me at owen@frontofficesports.com. So keep them coming. NCAA President Charlie Baker has called for the banning of prop bets on individual player performances in college sports. This is in the wake of an investigation on Toronto Raptors player Jontay Porter over whether he faked injuries and illness to influence prop bets on him. As we covered yesterday, whether or not he's guilty, a fringe NBA player making under $500,000 like Porter has less to lose than most NBA players when it comes to gambling schemes. Those same dynamics are in place for nearly every college athlete, the vast majority of whom make little to no money off their playing careers. Baker seemed to reference Porter when he said, quote, "The NCAA is drawing the line on sports betting to protect student athletes and to protect the integrity of the game. Issues across the country these last several days show there is more work to be done." Ohio, Vermont, and Maryland have already banned prop bets on the collegiate level. However, prop bets are not the only soft target for corruption. Temple is under investigation over suspicious betting activity on games earlier this season, in which betting lines moved dramatically shortly before games, showing that some bettors were suddenly anticipating that the team would underperform, which they did. With its many thousands of unpaid athletes, college sports represent a huge challenge in preventing corruption. The Miami Marlins were second to last in MLB attendance last year, familiar territory for them, with a home average of 14,355. This year, they are working to boost those numbers with a new menu item. The team is offering $52 all-you-can-eat seats. Through the seventh inning, fans can feast on unlimited hot dogs, nachos, cheeseburgers, peanuts, cookies, and non-alcoholic drinks. The one limit is that you can only take 4 items from each run to the concession stand. As enticing as that is, we'll have to see if that's enough to crack the perplexing challenge of baseball in Florida. Despite Miami's status as unofficial capital of Latin America, one of the most baseball-crazy parts of the world, and despite their occasional success and the Rays' consistent success, both teams regularly rank among the bottom in MLB attendance. But those who do show up can now enjoy the half-filled park with unlimited nachos. Up next, baseball is starting its season with a new owner taking over the reigning AL East champions, turmoil inside the MLB Players Association, and the league's biggest star getting attention for all the wrong reasons. I spoke to Washington Post national baseball writer Chelsea Janes about all that and plenty more. That's coming up next. Very excited to be joined now by Washington Post national baseball writer Chelsea Janes. Welcome, Chelsea.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you on. So first, it's been something of a weird offseason, but opening day is here. How are you feeling as we head into this baseball season?
Pretty excited to actually have baseball to talk about. I feel like it's been a pretty crazy winter of a lot of random storylines, and now we actually get to watch some games, which is great.
So the Orioles are now officially controlled by David Rubenstein. He'll own a majority stake soon. How do you think he'll alter the trajectory of that franchise?
You know, first of all, I think he just brings a little bit of a different vibe to them. I think the Angelos family was well known in Baltimore, but had recently kind of rubbed people the wrong way for many reasons, including how they handled negotiations with the city over the lease and how they've handled the payroll in recent years. So I think it just sort of injects goodwill by being someone other than them. And then in more broadly, you know, I asked him, he kind of did the rounds with media over the last week and, you know, didn't want to say that he's going to increase payroll, but did say that he'll try to defer to what Mike Elias recommends, which, you know, I think Orioles fans can kind of take as a decent sign. But generally speaking, he just seems like he wants to sort of foster goodwill on all fronts. And that I don't think was a priority for the previous regime, or if it was, they did not execute particularly well.
Yeah, I mean, they won the division last year, but the spending bar is so low with them. I mean, like, literally, if they signed one player to a multi-year contract, that would be a change from the Angelos in recent years.
Yes, I mean, completely. I think Craig Kimbrell from 1 year was bigger than anything they've done in quite some time. So they're going to have to make some big decisions coming up, obviously, with all their young players. And I think it's probably good to have someone making those decisions that you know might be open to them, as opposed to someone you know isn't.
The contractual and legal situation around Masson, the regional sports network the O's share with the Nationals, that's not changed, obviously, with this new ownership, but now they're new negotiating partners. Do you expect there to be some kind of thaw there where maybe a deal gets worked out?
I do. I have no idea what it looks like, but Rubenstein has said a lot in recent days that he wants to figure it out. But, you know, I think everyone kind of knew the Angelos family and the Lerner family, who owns the Nationals, resented each other for many reasons. And at times that Masson situation became about less about what was actually happening in the litigation and more about beating the other guy. I think for many reasons, you know, it's going to be easier with Rubenstein, one of which is, frankly, there's not that much money involved anymore. You know, we've seen cord cutting diminish the value of all those cable deals. That's happened for the Nats rights, the Orioles rights. So I think it's just going to be a little bit easier to unstick that whole thing. I don't know what that looks like, but Rubenstein seems pretty determined to do it.
Yeah, I think that's a good point about how just the Masson itself is now less valuable than it was, because whenever I think about that situation, I figure, like, on one hand, they should just make a deal. You know, that would just be better for baseball. It would certainly be better for the Nationals. But would it be better for the Orioles, because they just have this deal in perpetuity where they get more money from Masson than the Nationals do? And why give that up? But you know, there must be some way, right, to make this work for everyone.
I think so. And it seems like Rubenstein is more comfortable, if not giving up that money, sort of, I don't know. It's just absurd that, frankly, one team owns the rights to two teams. It owns the television rights to two teams. That doesn't exist anywhere in sports. And I think you had to have someone willing to kind of give up a little to fix it. And what he has indicated is he'd rather not spend as much on legal fees as that whole thing usually requires. So maybe he views it as saving money in the long run. But the Orioles also owe the Nats like $300 million in back rights fees and all this stuff. So I think there's probably some ways to work around and with all of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Once that gets worked out, do you expect the Nationals to go back on the market?
I don't know. They've been incredibly puzzling in how they've handled all this. I certainly think the fact that the Orioles owe them money is worth noting. You know, I don't think they're going to jump ship on that, you know, before the Lerners kind of take advantage of getting that money that they've waited for so long. And, you know, I don't know what will happen if it gets to the point that it's time to spend again. You know, they've been in this kind of rebuilding mode, but I think they hope that next winter they're ready to kind of start adding pieces in free agency and making this go again. And I don't know if the Lerners are open to doing that. I don't know if they will want to hand off the reins when it becomes time to do that. No one really knows. They've been sort of weird about this whole thing. So, you know, as of now, Mark Lerner said a few weeks ago, like, we're keeping the team. we're going to take it off the market. We're doing this. Sure. I think if someone comes in with $2.5 billion for them, that will change immediately. But I don't see that person coming. And so I think they don't either. And I think they're just going to kind of see what they can do.
It makes a lot of sense for them to wait 6 months, even if they want to sell the team eventually. They could maybe get this Masson situation sorted out, give the Strasburg and Scherzer contracts a little more time to age out of existence. Actually, I'm not sure where those are at this point, but you know, that's just an easier sell. And yeah, it could be worth at least $100 or $2 million tacked onto the sale price.
Yes, absolutely. And you're right. The Scherzer and Strasburg deals are still there. So there's kind of a lot of incentive. And I think, you know, even outside of Masson, which any new owner is going to want to have figured out, like baseball as a whole hasn't really figured out where the cable money is going to go and come from down the line. So if you wait until maybe next year, when it seems like they're really going to have to figure that out, maybe everyone gets a little more comfortable buying in or whatever. So I think there's a lot of reasons to think that if they wait, they'll be in a better spot. But I think that was also true when they first announced they were selling the team and they did that anyway. So who knows?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And on that, just baseball generally needing to figure out its deal when it comes to local broadcast, any spidey sense about like what direction this is all going to go?
You know, I think for a long time, Rob Manfred has wanted to find a way to get everybody, every team on a streaming service that he can then sell. They've got a pretty good history with MLB TV in terms of pioneering that kind of thing. So I believe that they can do it. The problem is, like, how are you going to get the Dodgers, who have this absolutely massive deal, or the Yankees and these teams that are in much better shape with that to become a part of it? I think like their TV deals preclude them from, you know, including their streaming rights on an MLB package. So they're going to have to figure that out. I think, and I have no one has told me this, that even those deals, you know, if the smaller deals for like the Rangers and the Guardians and all these Bally's teams are falling apart, then I think certainly deals for bigger teams that pay even more annually are going to start to be burdens on the companies that made them. You know, I don't think the money's there anymore. So maybe those deals start to get deconstructed and maybe that opens the door. But I think eventually having everybody on a streaming service that you can buy into is the goal. And I think Manfred has always been a little bit closer to that than it has seemed like publicly. Like, I think that's closer than maybe it feels.
Let's hop over to the MLBPA. So a bunch of player reps are calling for the ousting of Bruce Meyer, I think the deputy director, in favor of Harry Marino. What do you see as the core issue here? What's the discontent about?
First of all, I think that there are people in the PA who feel like they should have done better in the last collective bargaining agreement and whose arguments in that direction have been bolstered by a few things that have happened lately. I think the J.D. Davis arbitration situation with the Giants surprised some people, because while I think everyone knew on paper that if you went to arbitration, the deal wasn't guaranteed, that doesn't feel like something, you know, they should have agreed to. It was actually a gain for them compared to where things had been. But I think that whole thing is kind of has kind of jolted some players into being like, wait, maybe we didn't look at the fine print. And so that's part of it. And I think, you know, with all due respect to Bruce Meyer, he's not a fine print guy. You know, I covered the lockout. He's kind of big picture, you know, he wasn't someone who was getting into the nitty gritty. And I think that is starting to show. I also think that there is some concern over where the money's going there. I don't know if it's founded. I have heard those rumblings for a long time that these dues the players pay into, the money the MLBPA used to sort of give people money during the pandemic, stuff like that. Like, where is it going and where is it coming from? They also have had a few moments where they said they were going to pay into some charities for like pandemic workers, and those people said they didn't get it, and you know, all this stuff. So whether there's actually anything there or not, I think there's enough smoke that you saw Harry Marino calling for like an audit. That being said, I think the biggest factor is just that there are minor leaguers there now. They know Harry Marino better. I think fairly they don't trust Bruce Meyer and the negotiating committee that represents MLB to negotiate on their behalf. It's hard to do that. It's hard to negotiate for those two very different groups. But it sounds like, from what Tony Clark has said and Evan Drellick's great reporting at The Athletic and what I've heard behind the scenes, that they don't feel like the Harry Marino coup is actually going to work. But I think the fact that it got this far and got this public is a huge problem for the union, and they're going to have to really kind of buckle down and figure out what's going on there.
Yeah, and the J.D. Davis thing reminded me that the current CBA only runs through 2026, and so we're going to be doing all this again. I mean, we could be seeing another lockout in a couple years. What do you think the MLBPA is going to fight for the next CBA?
You know, I think the way free agency went this winter in terms of, you know, veteran guys not getting paid, whatever you think of it, why ever you think that happened, is going to be used as evidence that owners aren't spending. And I think that is going to be something they try to fix. They've tried to fix it in the past. The owners always try to get around it. I mean, I think, you know, and I think a lot of people agree that really the only way to fix that is to impose a salary floor and say, hey, you got to spend $100 million on your roster. If you can't do that, you can't be a part of this. But the problem with that is that if the players get that, and that is certainly like a positive for them, because it means more jobs, more payment and all that, the owners are going to want a salary cut. They're going to want to even the playing field. You're not going to get one without the other. And that is the one thing the MLB players will never do. And I think a lot of people think they shouldn't do. So I don't really know what you do with that. I think the idea of a salary cap has always been the thing that drives these conversations, that drives strikes, lockouts, everything. I think we're coming to another reckoning. You know, I don't see how this negotiation is going to be any less heated than the last one. And we almost lost games, did lose some time to that last time. So it's going to be, I think, pretty ugly. But I think ultimately, like, forcing owners to spend will be MLBPA's priority. And I don't know if there's a great way to do that other than one that, you know, that avoids the salary cap question and all of that.
We're sort of at I'm going to jinx this with these words, but it feels like a relative lull in the Ohtani saga right now. Like, we had our big wave of news and now we're kind of waiting for the next developments. What are you watching for in terms of, you know, next dominoes to fall?
I think it'll just be interesting to see what happens now. I think that we are at a lull, and then we saw Dave Roberts suggest, I think it was Tuesday, that, oh, you know, actually, Ipe's kind of made it hard for us to communicate with Ohtani over the years. And maybe we didn't have a full idea of, you know, what he wants. And, you know, this will be great. So they're kind of really stopping on Ipe here, which might be justified if the stories are true. But it'll be interesting to just watch that dynamic. I mean, like, we've never really seen Ohtani crack emotionally, but that guy was his best friend. He's never played a professional game in Japan or the States without him until last week. I mean, he has been able to handle everything that's come at him, but like, this is new. So that's kind of just my thing that I'm watching. But, you know, until investigations unearth more, it's kind of hard to say. And frankly, I think the way he came out in that press conference was so clear that it kind of is like, would they let him say that if, you know, it weren't true, because he could get sued for defamation. It really just exposes him. So I think he's, you know, done everything he can to kind of say, here's what happened. And, you know, it wasn't my fault. And until something overturns that, I think, you know, he'll just kind of play and everything will be status quo.
Yeah. I mean, that was my take on that press conference. I already said this on the show, but that if that weren't true, he's really put all his eggs in that basket. Yeah, so,
totally.
So yeah, it would be surprising if they did that, but it's a weird story. There's just a lot going on. Before we let you go, if you've got division winner picks on the top of your head, I'll take them, but mostly who's going to win the World Series and who are they beating?
It's a great question. I think the Atlanta Braves are the NL pennant winners, but I've said that before. The American League, I have no idea, but the Rangers looked pretty good. So if I had to say now, which I guess I do, I say Braves over Rangers, but I hope it's not that. I hope it's more interesting than that. I hope maybe the Orioles get in, or the Dodgers last, or the Phillies make a run again. But I think if you know, safest bet feels like Braves and Rangers, and I hope I'm wrong.
All right. Yeah, as a Mets fan, I also hope you're wrong. Chelsea James, thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Thanks for having me.
That's it for today. Send me those Apple reviews. We'll send you the FOS hat. It's a win-win. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.